I'm not sure if it feels this way to anybody else in the room, but this time of the year, like fall, often has a flavor for me of a new beginnings in a way that like the turn of the year does, like New Year's doesn't. That sort of feels like we're in the middle of the dark to me a lot of the time. It doesn't feel like we're starting anything new. It feels like we're just trying to get to the end of something we're already tired of. Maybe that's too bleak, but fall feels different than that to me. Fall feels like, yep, here we go. And I think part of that's probably a leftover from, you know, decades of being a student. It's a great line from the Mark Jordan song, September marked my life out of time. It just sort of feels like, okay, this term I'm going to, you know, study, whatever. Aspirational goals, right? Do-over. It sort of feels like a do-over season, a chance to try again, a chance to move forward on goals and aspirations. And goals and aspirations, things that we want to move toward or accomplish, really matter in our human experience. They're really important. And this is one of the things about being mortal that is interesting to me. My batteries, my personal batteries, are not dead yet. But even if things go unprecedentedly well for me, I am well past the reasonable midpoint of my life. Right? I mean, that's just the math. So, every once in a while, usually after I've either, you know, like on a somber note, after I've been to visit my, you know, aging parents who were talking about the end of life, or on a lighter note, but one that's physically more painful, after I've tried to keep up my kids on a mountain bike or something, I think about the end, you know? I think about that a little bit. And usually when I'm thinking about the end, that gets me thinking about what kind of legacy I'm leaving to my kids in particular. And a significant part of what I hope I've passed along already and will continue to champion in their lives is the idea that moving things forward is a big idea. Moving things forward is not an idea that's limited to our lifetime, to our singular human, personal human experience. And for me, that idea that moving things forward is a big one, a big idea that's not limited to our lifetimes, that is deeply connected to our explorations here at the table. Because when I think about my particular role here, I don't think of it as trying to get a group of people to some new understanding where we can all camp out together. What I feel like I'm trying to do is play my part in us learning together how to be evolving humans. How to be people that realize that we're part of a much, much bigger story that is going somewhere, and that if we choose to, we can play a part in. And if we choose to, we can play a positive part in. And not only that, but we get to encourage the people around us, whether that's our family, our friends, our partners, our colleagues, our wider culture, we get to encourage the humans around us to be a part of that too, if they wish to. When we read about Jesus leaving the sort of embodied part, the human part of the story of his life in the biblical book of John, it's in chapter 14, Jesus says this crazy thing. He says that those that carry on in his absence will do even greater things than he's been doing. So 2,000 years or so on from that, I think it's a worthwhile exercise to look around and ask, how are we doing with that? Is there anything left to be done? I also think it's important to keep some perspective on the timeline for all of this. This is the big idea part. I think it's easy to start to think and live as though our life, our embodied experience, is the only one that matters, and that somehow the unfolding of this larger story hinges somehow, kind of fundamentally, maybe even entirely, is what the emotional experience is like, on our own choices. And as I've just said, I think what we believe and what we choose matters a great deal, and I also think that we should try to keep a grip on the scale of what we're talking about here. Now, Tim Penner did some of this perspective taking last week from the vantage point of the known physical universe, from the vantage point of the size consideration of where we are as a planet, as a species. And I want to spend a few minutes on that important matter of scale as well, but from a slightly different point of view. Tim was kind enough to send me his notes so I could surf his wave without a full-on collision happening, but if you feel like I'm covering some of the same ground, it just means I didn't read carefully enough. When it comes to perspective taking, like Tim, I find the folks that look at the stars quite helpful. Those people tell me that in terms of time, the known universe is 13.7 billion years old. Let's try to put that into space, not just time. If we were to travel at the speed of light, which is 186,000 miles per second, by the way, if you want to put that into geographical space, that's the speed we would have to travel to make 40 round trips between here and Vancouver in 1 second. So 186,000 miles per second. If we were to travel at that speed, it would take us about 100 billion years to get from one end of the universe to the other. So that's pretty big. We would have to travel, well, let's do the math. Light travels at 5.87 trillion miles a year. So if we were traveling at that speed for 100 billion years, how long it would take, we would have traveled 586 sextillion miles to get from one end of our universe to the other. That's the number 587 followed by 21 zeros. I don't do math, but I don't think it matters in this particular instance because that's an incomprehensibly large number, right? Like a calculator melting kind of number, but there is more. So this already unimaginably large universe contains maybe as many as a trillion galaxies. All those galaxies are thousands of light years apart. We've just been talking about how far a light year is. That's how far apart they are. Each of those galaxies contains billions and billions of stars. Those billions and billions of stars within those galaxies are also light years apart. And by the way, it's expanding. So, and on top of that, current science is increasingly speculating that there's more than one of these things that I've just described. So if we don't have a headache yet, let's go in the other direction just for a moment. At the small end of the scale, we have atoms, right? Atoms are about 1/10 millionth of a millimeter across, and they contain subatomic particles, which are smaller. So let's set the Earth into that context for a moment. We can kind of comprehend the Earth, right? Like this is what Tim was kind of trying to help us get a grip on with Sagan's little blue dot the other day. We can kind of make pictures of that. In the context of time, our little blue dot of a planet is pretty young. 4.5 billion years old. And if we took that number, the age of the Earth, and we laid it out so that it was equal to the length of a football field. Doesn't matter if it's Canadian or American field, the numbers are big enough to absorb the difference. The average human lifespan would stretch about 4/100ths of an inch from the goal line. To put that into context, that's a sheet of paper is 100 times thicker than that. This may seem like an odd point to take from all of that, but stay with me. So, because of all these things, what we believe and choose matters. What we believe and do actually shows up, actually is integral to the story, and it is part of something much, much, much bigger. So when we talk about God, that which by definition is much bigger than all we can observe. Think about what we've just been observing for a moment, if you will. I wasn't trying to waste our collective time. Sense of scale. God, by definition, is much bigger than all we can observe. And we talk about cooperating with God on anything. We should probably, as part of that same process, have at least two responses. One is that we should just chill about getting it right. Okay? Like, honestly. Whatever our best take is on what to believe or what might be best to do, it's part of a larger story that is so incomprehensibly larger that the thought that we would get it right in any absolute sense is categorically ridiculous. This does not stop being the case when we start doing theology or making religions, okay? It's just a silly way to think about the human endeavor. Doesn't make sense. We should just, like, let the air out of the balloon. It's okay. We don't have to get it right in that sense. We cannot get it right. The idea that we can get it right, I would contend, is an enormously destructive one. The other response that seems really reasonable to me is that we should remind ourselves that in the end, we're dealing with a mystery. And that implies, among other things, that we will never have the last word. We will never arrive at some understanding or way of operating vis-a-vis the divine that sews it all up. Always mystery. Which means, it seems to me, that whenever we get into that terrain, that's about being conscious of it. We're always in that terrain. But whenever we get into that terrain, we should expect some surprises. We should expect some twists and turns. We should expect some new insights or ideas. We should experience that there is plenty of room to explore. And we should, if we are exploring something of this magnitude, we should expect to make more than a few changes to what we thought we knew along the way. Which brings me back, at least sort of, to our exploration about the roots of human morality, which is the terrain that we've been in. Post-Darwin, Darwin, by the way, depending where you grew up, Darwin might have just been a bad guy, someone you should avoid learning about at all costs, but Darwin is a fascinating character with his own very interesting story, rather profound spiritual struggle and journey, well worth reading about. Post-Darwin, we feel pretty clear collectively as a culture that there isn't some point on those timelines that I was just outlining, you know, that 1/100,000th of a inch part of the timeline, the human part of the timeline. There's no point on that timeline where humans were perfect. We're mortals. And we're mortals on a rather intriguing evolutionary journey that stretches back billions of years. And that's a perspective in itself that as soon as you look at the story from that perspective, it upends the idea of approaching the fall as a literal historical event. It just kind of does not work. I've talked before about how profound an impact it can have on what we think matters in this life if we consider history as opening into an increasing range of possibilities rather than closing down toward a predetermined endpoint. So the shape of the model, I've drawn this in the past, I'm not going to do that this morning, but if we think about history as from where we sit and look at it and are experiencing it as going like this in terms of possibilities rather than closing in on some destination that is already pre-written. Totally different perspective on the way we choose and live in the world. Similar picture here. Instead of imagining the human moral journey as starting from a point of perfection and then toppling downward, try imagining it in a way that takes what we know about the evidence of the evolution of the species into account. If you do that, where it takes me at least is into a picture of humans as rising through the rather profound marvel of evolution to become the beings with the startling capacities that we have today. The model changes from perfect tumbling into the abyss to the evolutionary shape, this opening shape, the same shape that I talked about for history, where the possibilities actually grow rather than shrink. Different vantage point. I don't think we would, any of us, argue that we have no agency. We seem to have quite a lot of freedom to act in the world, which is what I mean by agency. That's why we get so fussed when people threaten to blow one another up, because we could do that, right? If this was just rhetoric, it'd be like, yeah, rhetoric away. But because we have these capacities to act in the world, this stuff gets to us. We have a lot of agency. We are beings with a rather breathtaking amount of capacity to help shape our own destiny and that of the world in general. I think this is part, when I read the ancients in our sacred text, I kind of think, this. I can hear them wrestling with this. When the psalmist says that we're fearfully and wonderfully made, That's an agency commentary. It's poetic, but it's about capacity to act in the world. Wow, we can do things that matter, and that matter a lot. We have a lot of agency. And behind the capacity of both our very best and our very worst lies the most highly evolved brain to ever exist on this planet, as far as we know. That's what's running in the background. Lots of folks have thought about some of the linkages between this and the ancient origin stories we find in Genesis. Jeremy and I, those of you that are a regular part of this community know Jeremy, we had this conversation after our gathering a couple of weeks ago, and he reminded me about a CBC Massey lecture series in which the speaker, this is not a religious series, but in which the speaker made some fascinating connections between the way we've evolved and the way that we act. So, for instance, one of the reasons we form such strong bonds at birth is because we're all born premature. And I know we don't tend to think about it that way. We tend to think about there's this term, and at the end of the term, the baby's born, and full term is mature babies should be born, right? We're all born immature. There's no way we'd fit through the birth canal if our brain was full size. Wouldn't happen. And as a result, we are born vulnerable. And as a result of that, we form bonds to those who protect us until we're able to protect ourselves. That's a Genesis story. Takes a little imagination. I'll leave it there. We're going to keep going. There's lots of ways we could explore this, but for our purposes this morning, we're going to try this. David Sloan Wilson, author of a book called Evolution for Everyone, How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives, puts this marvel of the evolved and evolving human brain into the context of time, so that big scale that we were talking about at the beginning. He puts it in there this way. So he's describing how our brain got to be what it is. Our unique attributes evolved over a period of roughly 6 million years. So these are the attributes of our brain. They represent modifications of great ape attributes that are roughly 10 million years old, primate attributes that are roughly 55 million years old, mammalian attributes that are roughly 245 million years old, vertebrate attributes that are roughly 600 million years old, and attributes of nucleated cells that are perhaps 1,500 million years old. To put that into the context of our everyday lives, the oldest parts of our brain are preoccupied with survival, right? Things like food and sex, safety, so you can enjoy food and sex. This, by the way, that must have been true, huh? This is, by the way, one of the ways to understand why the ancient gods that Tim was talking about last week had their libidos like turbocharged all the time, okay? This is about the evolution of the way we think. So that's the oldest part of our brain. That's what that's preoccupied with. And the good news, I suppose, is that that's not the whole story, although it does provide an interesting window into why we would look askance at an adult for whom eat, drink, and be merry comprises a complete worldview. We might say to such a person, or of such a person, they need to grow up. That's really interesting, isn't it? They need to evolve. They need to actually start operating out of some other part of their brain than the oldest part. Let's keep going. If we keep digging into this evolution of the brain, then there's a newer or younger part of the brain in terms of evolution that provides us with things like emotion, with the desire to bond with others and nurturing relationships. There are other, still younger parts that equip us with the ability to reason and to rationalize. That's the part of our brain that's equipped to do things like choose between competing drives and instincts. Very important part, right? That's why we don't just eat, drink, and be merry with no regard for the other humans if we actually use the whole brain. And then there are the more recently acquired parts of our brain, and they give us self-awareness. They give us the ability to do what we're doing here this morning, to ask a question like, why are we here? What does it mean? To experience things like longing or hope or spiritual aspirations. We couldn't make a religion without this part of our brain. And I'm pretty sure that last part of the list, self-awareness, experiencing things like longing, hope, spiritual things, I'm pretty sure that last part of the list is populated with things that are utterly foreign to my dog. And I love my dog. My dog is like a child. I say this with some reservation. My dog knows nothing about what I just described. Because my dog is not a human. Even on her best day, she's a dog. These are the things, people, that make us human. All right? Now, depending on what sort of narrative you grew up with, this could all be feeling to you by now like you just came to a church that didn't bother talking about God, which would be to rather thoroughly miss the point. The fact that we are equipped to explore what we believe, the reason that this community exists to do that, is inextricably interwoven with the existence of God. Let me unfold that this way. A literal reading of Genesis is not compatible with what science has taught us about our origins. But God and evolution are not competing options. I don't think that is inconsistent with a Christian understanding of the universe. God, we learn in that tradition, is creator spirit, to use biblical language, not a distant clockmaker, but if we want to try to image this, more like the breath in the lungs of cosmic evolution. One of the challenges with most of our concepts of God is that they're way, way, way too small. And I've said before, I believe this, our concepts of God are very, very important handles. They're very important access points. But none of our concepts of God even come close to being the last word on the nature of God. God is, I feel very uncomfortable saying this sentence, but I'm going to keep going if we can share the understanding that I'm talking about another access point. All right? God is language doesn't tend to behave that way. It's like you're summing up. I'm not summing up. God is ultimate reality. How else do you put language around something that's beyond any concept we have? God is that which transcends and fills everything. I said this to a group of people in the spring, or something like this. To a group of people whose theology would be quite, we would use the language of fundamentalism for it, quite recognizably sort of in that stream of Christianity. And when we got evaluations back, they were all like, who's the New Age guy who doesn't believe in God? Like, well, actually, I sort of believe really generously in God. I'm trying to make this apparent. everywhere, you know? Anyway, didn't resonate with them. It's fine. We could say, I didn't say this. I'll say it here. I didn't say it there. I'm not completely blithe about this. We could even say that God doesn't exist, even as a superbeing, but is rather existence itself. Big idea. See, whenever we make a concept of God, we put a boundary around the divine. We need those boundaries because an everywhere boundaryless being, like those words don't fit together for us because we have an embodied experience. So we need those images. We just need to call them what they are. They're limited images. They're access points. They're a way to try to get a grip, to get our arms around something that's way too big for us to get our arms around. We shouldn't mistake the handle for the thing that the handle's on. Right? And you can hear, and this is an interesting thing, if you start looking for it, you can see this concept being wrestled with in the Bible. In Colossians, Paul's trying to describe God. He's trying to put words around God. And so he says God is before all things. What does that mean? Now we're into the terrain of everywhere. Okay? Like we're into the train where time's not behaving itself in a nice, tidy, linear fashion. God is before all things. God, Paul says in that same text, is a being that is a being in which all things consist. I wish I could have had a chance to try to translate that. Right? Well, how do you a being in which, in a different translation, all things hold together? All things, people, is very inclusive. Not all images match. Not all concepts play nice. but just flat out, all things consist everywhere. What gets left out of all things? Anyone? If we think about what Paul knew about the universe when he wrote that, compared to what we know about the universe when we read that, we realize that he wrote it without the benefit of, among other things, Tim and I's extremely cursory, very pop science take on space and time in the last 2 weeks. I didn't ask you if I could sum your thing up as pop science. Is that fair? Yeah, okay. We're friends. We'll work it out. That's pretty fascinating that a guy who's working without that information would put language like that around the divine, isn't it? All things hold together outside of time. If we want to take an even older text in terms of the history of human thought about the divine, we could take a text from Proverbs in which the writer talks about God as possessing them, the writer, in the beginning of his way, even before his works of old. Like, can you hear the poets kind of grinding on this and going, how do we talk about this? How do we talk about the existence of God when we can't get ourselves around it, when it's not us? When our biggest experience is, the deeper we fall into it, the more we realize our biggest experience is just so not big enough for what we're talking about. And then we have to work with language yet. We have to try to make sounds about this that other people will take something from about it. And, right? So I think that's intriguing. That whenever people have sort of stopped whatever information they had, because man, if this keeps going the way it's going, 20 years from now, we're having the same conversation. We're going to be going, can you believe that 2 decades ago we didn't know X? But now we know X, so let's talk about God with X in mind. Let's take this new information and bring it to bear on our exploration of what it means to be in a universe where there's a divine being or not. We're trying to talk about that. But let's take this stuff that we have to work with into account. So, I haven't forgotten what I'm talking about here, topically. So we'll get back. So the seeds of some of this way of looking at our moral origins are visible in sacred text. And that's important because it can help us to imagine that what we might use, say, sin language for, can also be thought of in more than one way. So we can conceive of sin, for example, as disobedience to a set of rules that's laid down by God. That's a very familiar framework, right? Break one of God's rules, you sin. We can also conceive of sin and evil as a consequence of the process of evolution. So are goodness and love consequences of the process of evolution. Our ability, that unfolding ability that I outlined for the way that we can think and look at things and choose between things, it's from that capacity that our understanding of ideas like good and evil come. If we did not have the brain we have, those concepts would be meaningless to us. Possibility of good and evil, and sometimes that improbable moral complexity that seems to combine the two, those capacities are built into our DNA. That's remarkable. That's way beyond biology. We're going to explore that a little bit more next week, but I want to leave us with this. A friend of mine who was writing about the nature of the universe that they feel that they occupy wrote this lovely sentence. He described the world in which we live as a meaning-drenched universe made sensible by deep traditions worthy of reverent observation. I'm going to read that again. We live in a meaning-drenched universe made sensible able to be sensed, made sensible by deep traditions, worthy of reverent observation. When we explore what we believe, we are doing the work, we are making the assumption that there's something to explore, meaning-drenched universe. We are doing the work of approaching it with the tools that we have, making it sensible. And we are doing that standing firmly in this particular community in a tradition that has done it throughout its history. Not irreverently, but with deep respect and consideration. I would add to that that a meaning-drenched universe is made sensible by deep traditions worthy of reverent observation and ceaseless exploration. I think that ceaseless exploration is part of reverent observation. Otherwise, what you end up with is just a re-examination of an anachronism, something that's operating in a world from which it did not originate. And that's not good enough. As with right and wrong, these are things about which we get to choose. We don't have to explore what we believe. We actually don't. We don't have to be kind. We can be unkind. We don't have to wrestle with the implications of the moral conundrums that we face moment by moment, day by day, that our culture faces, that our planet faces. We can sort of step to the side. We can actually operate out of the oldest part of our brain if we want. Not kick in the front part at all. Eat, drink, and be merry. Why? Because tomorrow somebody bigger is going to club you. So if you want to get your buzz on, you better do it today. Right? We get to choose about this stuff. And one of the great joys in my life is to be part of a community in which there is a collective commitment to exploring what we believe, to actually banging away at this stuff and seeing where it takes us. So if your heresy tank isn't full yet, you can come back next week and, you know, we'll top it up. I just want to leave you with a reminder that the origins of the word heresy are the exact same linguistic origins as the word choice. Peace.